This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. On this episode, we discuss prize fighting and its relationship with martial arts.
All right, so today we're going to talk about prize fighting.
Yeah, which is, I think that lots of people maybe don't understand the concept of prize fighting and what being a prize fighter actually entails. And the number one thing it entails, in my opinion, is entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you are fighting not only as your source of income, but you're fighting to entertain people.
Sure. And it's a lot of the time that kind of conflict you kind of sometimes have between martial artists and fighters, in that I think that's what's lost a lot of the time. That, you know, it's not really something that's a part of martial arts. In fact, it's often looked down upon, kind of the concept of that. But the thing is, fighters are entertainers. And the fact is that if you think of, you know, the guys with the bad guy personas out there, you know, they're generally bigger stars in the fight game. Yeah. Like that. And it's a part of the business with it a little bit. So I used to hate Chael Sonnen. This is a good example.
Which is funny, because you know what's crazy is I was a Chael Sonnen fan before he put on the act.
Really?
I like, obviously, we've had this conversation before, but I lean to grapplers. He's a phenomenal grappler.
Yeah.
And I remember his first UFC stint, watching him, and then I was a fan then. I think he lost both matches in his first UFC stint.
Yeah.
But I watched him, and I was like, man, this guy's a great grappler. Nobody cared who he was.
Yep.
And he put on the act of the persona so he could sell. And we can talk about this more in depth. He's a great example of somebody to go into with.
Well, I first you know, heard of Chael Sonnen with the fight he had with Anderson Silva.
Yeah, and that's around the time when he started putting on the act.
I didn't really start to like him kind of until he was towards the end of his career, when he started to do a lot more commentary martial art. He's pretty much my favorite commentator. I listen to Bad Guy Incorporated. I don't know if you do, but I listen to this stuff all the time.
Yeah, I do. There's a funny story I want to tell about him, but I want to save it.
Okay.
Save it for later, because I think that, there is being a martial artist, and what people consider a martial artist is at odds a lot with being a prize fighter.
Sure.
Yeah. I think that's something that's like huge to keep in mind, because,
well, it's just the entertainment, you know, aspect of being a prize fighter is just not present in martial arts practice pretty much ever. So, you know, that's why I think that's where it comes in. It's something that rubs a lot of martial artists the wrong way, in that, you know, they look at these fighters who, you know, aren't respectful or, you know, sportsmanlike a lot, and they're like, screw this guy, you know, he's an embarrassment, you know, to the martial arts and stuff like that. I was like, that guy's an entertainer. He's just trying to get you to pay attention to him, and he needs to make a living. And a lot of fighters, you know, there's only a couple of fighters that are making really good money, and they're at the very top. Most of them, you know, it's like making decent money, but it's something that they gotta fight for it to try to do better.
Yeah, so like I think that all these guys are martial artists.
Sure, yeah.
But they aren't carrying themselves in a way that most people consider. It's, again, we're talking about kind of the traditional martial arts values.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because, again, jiu-jitsu to a certain extent has that, but also kind of didn't, because I feel like jiu-jitsu, more so than all the other martial arts, was based off... there was a ton of dojo storming with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And there's dojo storming with other martial arts. I don't think people realize that. You know, this, because I'm pretty sure your martial art that you do, Tung Sudo, has a background of dojo storming.
I mean, you know, karate in like the 80s, 70s and 80s in the United States, that kind of stuff happened all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you know, you're running your school, a new school opens up close enough to you to become a direct competitor. I mean, people in my own organization, they used to just show up there and fight the other students.
Yeah,
it's like that kind of stuff. A lot of it's cultural too, that, you know, the kind of the attitudes that we have about fighting as a society now, it's something that people are a lot more a lot more sensitive about, but, you know, used to be a lot more common.
Yeah, I mean, the foundation of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is based off dojo storms.
Sure.
Pretty much of coming in and being like, I'm gonna challenge you right now.
Yep.
I'm going to show you that jiu-jitsu is superior to, and again, I think it happened, but that's like the foundation of jiu-jitsu. So jiu-jitsu has a little bit less of, I think, some of the traditional values that you find in most martial arts. But even that, I think sometimes that gets overblown and sometimes it gets understated. It depends who you're talking to.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of super respectful martial artists in
Jiu-Jitsu. At the end of the day, it's just kind of like, it's not that there aren't disrespectful people in martial arts. You know, no matter what style you're part of. But it's like people generally don't want to train, you know, with guys that are unpleasant to be around. You know, a lot of times. So it's just a general social thing. A certain amount of, you know, kind of respectfulness to your training partners and the people you're around a lot is just the way most people operate in it. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess let's start, you know, talking about this more is the big shows. So the boxing, boxing and MMA are really the only two big shows. And then kickboxing and Muay Thai are popular in certain sections of the world. But that's really, those are really the four
grappling competitions kind of like next
now to gain popularity. But again, that's really young in the grand scheme of things. Like,
sure.
I think there's sections in the world where judo is probably relatively popular.
Yeah.
Huge, like Japan, some places probably in Europe. But like the local, or not even the local, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu tournaments that travel that are traditional, like tournament style things. Those aren't prize fights.
It's not a spectator thing.
Exactly. Yeah. You're paying to compete, and then you compete, and
it's an event that's for martial artists.
Exactly.
You know, that's it.
So the thing is that the boxing, the fake wrestling,
That's what's interesting about wrestling is that it's like kind of like, you know, professional wrestling is very popular. I mean, more popular than MMA? Maybe not more than boxing.
I don't know about currently, but it used to be.
It's close.
It
yeah, anyway.
Now, who knows?
They just went that way, like, entirely, where it's all the show. It's all the entertainment.
So you have fake professional wrestling, you have boxing and MMA in the United States, and then you have kickboxing, Muay Thai, and judo in some other sections of the world. That are kind of like the spectator sport.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know,
martial arts slash
you're in
prize fighting arts.
You're in Southeast Asia, those are the most popular sports in all those countries.
So the thing is that the second you've decided to compete in those sports, your number one thing that you are doing is entertaining people.
Mm-hmm.
So like, to a certain extent, it's not true of everybody, but you almost have to entertain first.
Mm-hmm.
And be a martial artist second.
It depends. I think there's certain fighters, like two that come to mind are GSP and Mighty Mouse, right? They're guys that are so good.
Yeah.
Well, they're like really the best, you know, some of the best that have ever competed in MMA that, you know, they don't really need to put on that persona to have a following. Now, you could ask yourself, though, like GSP, pretty big, but I would always say with Mighty Mouse that would his following be bigger if he was more of a conscious entertainer?
So I think that George St. Pierre is a great example of somebody who crossed over.
Yep.
Who crossed over and somehow found a way to be a martial artist who crossed over into prize fighting.
Yeah.
But I think he's the only one who did it with success. I think that Mighty Mouse was pretty much kicked out of the UFC because they were like, nobody wants to watch you fight.
Yeah.
So that tells you everything you need to know about you know, his approach. And again, there's something wrong. I think his approach is great. I prefer that approach, but I'm a martial artist.
Sure. You're watching Mighty Mouse fight, it kind of just like the word mastery kind of comes to mind with the stuff that he's doing, that he's just, and you know, people would argue that the level of competition that he was facing in that flyweight division, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, wasn't as high as in other divisions.
Yeah, about that. Those guys
are
super talented.
I'm sure they are.
They don't have the power to maybe get as many knockouts as the heavyweight division, but if you watch the heavyweight division, most of the time it's either knockout or one of the sloppiest, worst displays of technique you'll ever see in your entire life.
Any division in the UFC, you know, when you get to the top of it, you're going to have guys that are phenomenal. Martial artists, phenomenal athletes, but you know, I think just the popularity. I mean, the argument I guess would be that maybe smaller guys are less likely to get into the fight game as opposed to the other divisions that are more Like, I'm sure if you look at it by the numbers, like how many competitors there even were in that flyweight division versus how many competitors there are in, you know, the light heavyweight division, that it's probably, you know, yeah, there's probably a disparity there.
So I actually think, I think the probably flyweight and light heavyweight are actually probably around the same numbers. Light heavyweight is pretty slim. Light heavyweight and heavyweight are the two slimmest divisions, just because there's that's not the average size of people.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like people that are on the high end of being big, and 125 and 135
yeah,
are
that makes
on
sense.
The low end okay. of being small. So yeah. usually, so the deepest division is actually 155, because those are the people that are actually walking around probably at about 170, 185.
Yeah, the average sized person. Yeah. Yeah.
170 is a bunch of guys that are like pretty much usually 190 to 200 pounds.
Sure. Yeah.
And then 185 is when you start to see the drop off, because the 180, everybody's cutting weight, which this is a whole nother conversation I'm going to save for another time, is obviously the weight cap cutting thing, which is something that I think we've touched on briefly, and something you and I have talked outside of the
it
podcast.
It comes up all the time when we're talking here.
It's I think we need to do a whole episode on
sure
on just weight cutting. But like, so martial arts and being a martial artist is probably for the most part only going to sell to the martial arts crowd.
Yeah,
where if you do the trash talking and you're focused on being an entertainer, you can sell to everyone.
Yeah.
Because the thing is that if you're a good martial artist, as far as technique, then other martial artists are going to appreciate it.
Yep.
And they're going to look past whatever things they dislike about your persona, your public persona, which is, again, an act. But the average person, who is really most people that are watching, has no martial arts experience. They just want to be entertained.
Yeah.
They want to see trash talk. They want to see blood. They want to see knockouts. They want to see violence.
Sure.
They don't want to see respect.
Yeah.
They don't want to see class. They don't want to see, and or not, maybe even if they want to see, they can't, don't have the understanding of like, man, why is, what's making the way that this person kicks so special?
Mm-hmm.
What is making like this counter striker so great? So I'd like to talk about Anderson Silva, who in our lifetime is one of the probably like five greatest MMA fighters so far.
He's from that generation where I got into MMA.
So like, Anderson Silva would, especially if you watch his old fights before he was in the UFC, would put on these crazy spectacles when he would walk out, like doing like dress up like Michael Jackson and dance, so he would entertain.
I've seen that before.
Not much for trash talking. I don't think there's any real history of trash talking from him.
Yeah.
But incredible technique. So he's a counter puncher.
Yep.
And as a striker, you can speak on this better than me. So the thing is that when he would run into people that weren't overly aggressive,
mm-hmm.
his fights would be terrible. They'd be boring.
Yep.
There's actually a fight against Damian Maia where he gets booed. Mm-hmm. There's a fight around there too where he took on another Brazilian guy, and I can't remember his name right now. But the guy was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, not hyper aggressive. And the match is pretty much nothing for five rounds. It's 25 minutes of almost nothing. It's Anderson Silva waiting for the guy to come forward. The guy's not really coming forward because he knows that if he gets overly aggressive with the takedown, he's probably getting caught.
Yeah.
So those fights are they get booed and nobody wants to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But when the stars align for Anderson Silva, he has the entertainment value of walking down, doing a Michael Jackson dance, and then he has the entertainment value of being a phenomenal fighter, where as soon as somebody's willing to come forward and engage, he's going to pick them apart.
Sure, yeah. That's definitely what he did best.
So, like, he's a good example of, like, that sort of being able to cross over and can keep the integrity of the martial arts while being an entertainer.
Yep.
You have a George St. Pierre, who, in my opinion, is a guy who just kept all the integrity of martial arts and being a martial artist,
mm-hmm.
and he transcended and became popular.
Sure. Another guy that's an example of that is Lyoto Machida. All karate guys love. You know, it's like, because he's another example of a guy, you know, a little bit of a unique case in that not only, there are a lot of MMA fighters who have karate backgrounds, but with Machida, it was very clear when you watched him fight that he came from a karate background.
Yeah.
And he was similar to George St. Pierre, that, you know, he was always respectful.
But you know what separates George St. Pierre from Machida and Anderson Silva?
how dominant he was. Yeah.
I'm actually going to say he's the one of the three of them that never tested positive for anything illegal substances.
Yep.
So again, it's
in Machida's defense, he did like turn himself in though when he tested positive.
He was cheating.
What
it is, you know. So that's again, I can't really think of any person who transcended the like being a martial artist and being a prize fighter.
Yeah.
Who was popular better than George St. Pierre.
No, yeah, definitely.
But like that's the thing is so the average person just wants to be entertained. Mm-hmm. So how do you entertain them? You entertain them from being so like Anderson Silva again didn't talk trash.
Yeah.
But if you watch some of his fights, he showboats in the middle of
matches. Yeah, definitely.
And
that's
actually what made him lose the title ultimately to Chris Weidman.
Yeah,
he started dancing and being goofy in the middle of the match.
Yeah.
And he got away with that for a lot of time, but
finally got clipped. Yeah.
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 You know, and then on the opposite end, now let's talk about the guys that focus on like they're like, I'm gonna be a prize fighter first,
mm-hmm.
and I know my martial arts skills are good. Great, maybe even like excellent, but if I don't sell myself as a prize fighter first, I'm never going to be able to sell to people, and I want to sell to people first. And so Conor McGregor's a great example of that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And he's a great martial artist, but he's an even better prize fighter of selling himself and selling this persona and selling this like trash talking thing.
No, there's never a star like him in MMA. Before or since, not that I mean he's still around, but he kind of captured people's attention better. And you know, like, so this is where I guess good to look at somebody like McGregor, because it's like he was destroying his competition.
Yeah,
you know, he was stopping everybody in the division. You know, it's like fights weren't even going. Yeah, there wasn't even really much of a contention. He was just destroying everybody. And then on top of that, he had this very big, colorful kind of like persona that he had for himself, where he was just very good at the trash talking.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think that combination. So to be fair to the trash talkers of the fight world out there, it's like you have to have the ability first, right? And McGregor is still a good example too, that, you know, he was very, very dominant, destroying the competition. And talking a lot of trash the whole way through for a while, and people loved him. And now that he's had a couple of losses and is hardly fighting at all, but just continues to trash talk, he's become a lot more disliked by a lot of people. Is that it's that you need to back the trash talking up. You have to be winning. You have to be doing well.
Yeah, I agree and disagree because. So Colby Covington, who's right now, he's about to fight for the title next weekend on the 14th. He's a great example.
Absolutely.
I don't know that people know this, but everything about Colby Covington's persona is an act.
Yep.
And Colby Covington was going to be cut from the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
They said
he was winning.
He was like, he was like, at the time, he was like 9-1.
Yep.
And they were like, we don't care if you win or lose. You were getting cut from the UFC. Nobody wants to watch you fight. You're boring. All you do is out-grapple people.
Yep.
Nobody cares. And he grew up and had Chael Sonnen as a mentor.
And oh, that made, I never knew that. That makes sense.
Yeah. Chael Sonnen has known him since he was really young.
Yeah.
So, again, who knows what the full story is, because obviously it's entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you watch stuff on Colby Covington before that or follow any of his social media stuff before that, you'll find a guy who's super respectful.
I saw an interview with him. Not an interview, but it was just kind of a video of him talking to a fan.
Super nice guy.
Sure, really nice
Everybody guy. Says that.
And he told the fan. I think that...
The guy was like, why can't you be like this all the time?
And he said something like, he's like, I think you should show this side of yourself to people more often because it's really cool.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he said. Like, he said, doesn't sell.
So like the thing is that... He was going to be released.
Yeah.
And he went to Brazil and was matched up against Damian Maia.
Yeah.
He beat up Damian Maia. He crushed him.
Yeah.
He actually really set the blueprint better than anyone on how to defeat Damian Maia.
Yeah.
And even though, like, now everybody's doing revisionist history, it's like, oh, Usman, because Usman took him on later, and they're like, Usman dominated him. Not like Colby Covington did.
Sure.
Colby Covington is extremely talented, and anybody who thinks otherwise doesn't have an eye for martial arts and actual skill. But he was faced with a decision. He knew he was getting released.
Yep.
So he was, after the match, after he won, he went and he started saying a bunch of stuff to insult Brazilian people and got booed. Yeah, and then hated, and then they were like, okay, we're not releasing you now.
I would say that Colby Covington does a particularly good job of being really, really, like, dislikable.
He's doing the better job than anybody else of playing the bad guy, the professional wrestling heel thing, which he learned from Chael Sonnen, and Chael Sonnen did it first. So let's talk about Chael Sonnen, because so like I said, one of my best training partners is a guy named Ross, who we should actually have on here soon. So he's a wrestler first, and then he got into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Sure. Him and I've spent more time training Jiu-Jitsu with him probably than any person in the world. So both of us, I remember we like instantly hit it off just talking about Chael Sonnen and Kazushi Sakuraba. Yeah. And like talking about that era of like Team Quest, which was Matt Linlin, Dan Henderson, Randy Couture, and they built just this crazy team. Sokaju, Yushin Okami, Chael Sonnen, Ed Herman, a bunch of guys that made it to the UFC and were fighting in Pride in Japan. So Chael Sonnen was a wrestler, and he would just mostly dominate people through wrestling and grappling and then win decisions. Super respectful guy, awesome, super nice. Nobody wanted to see him fight.
Yep.
And he took the concept of the professional wrestling heel being the bad guy that people want to see lose, and he took on that persona. If you watch his second run in the UFC, the beginning of his second run of the UFC where he was beating everyone, which eventually led to him getting the title shot against Anderson Silva, if you look at the beginning part of that run, he's beating people and not saying anything. He's being respectful and nice and being himself. The switch doesn't happen until later when he gets close to that title fight, because he knows he's not going to get the title fight unless he starts entertaining. So he starts the trash talk. There's a funny – this is the story I was going to tell. There's a funny interview on ESPN before Chael Sonnen, because I think he works for ESPN now, and I think he has for a while. Or at least he used to. Maybe he doesn't anymore. But he's on, interviewed right around the Anderson Silva fight. It might be after the first fight and before the second Anderson Silva fight or before it. And he's getting interviewed, and the person who's interviewing it goes, I was talking to you backstage, and you're one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my entire life. So how much of this is an act? And he knows that he can't be sold out. Mm-hmm. So he instantly starts insulting her.
Yeah.
Because he's like, if people know what I'm really like,
sure,
they're not going to want to hate me.
Yeah,
I need them to hate me so they'll come and see me and watch me. And he, honestly, he carried a lot of guys, whether he won or lost, he carried them into making their fights wanting to be watched because they wanted people wanted to see him lose. People hated him. It's the same thing. He has a famous conversation or interview where he talks about Wanderlei Silva. Because Wanderlei Silva was like, I'm going to kill you if I see you out on the streets. And he's like, dude, it's cool to say that, but this isn't real. And he's like, I want to be the bad guy. Yeah. So this is a persona and an act. I want everybody to hate me, so let's do it. And they did the Ultimate Fighter together. And Wanderlei Silva starts doing a bunch of trash talk, which was like making him look like the bad guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, Wanderlei, I'm telling you, I've done all the work for us. Just let me be the person that everybody hates. Make yourself really likable, and everybody will want to watch this fight. And Wanderlei didn't get that.
Yep.
And like, again, Wanderlei Silva is a guy who I think, I love Wanderlei Silva. And again, probably, well, he was on steroids. So again, maybe not the best example of prize fighter versus martial artist. But if you look at him, he's not a guy who I think, he talks some trash, but not a ton of trash. Sure. Usually the people he talked trash to were people that he felt disrespected him in some way first.
Yep. You know, one of the best ways to think it was ever, or I forget where I read this or I heard this, but you know, the kind of, it made sense to me that they said like the kind of pressure that fighters have to be under. And, you know, it's what any, pretty much any combat sport, I would say especially MMA, you know, it's a brutal sport to participate in. And I think that, you know, there has to be like a connection that fighters have to feel to each other to a certain extent, because I mean, like, who else is going through exactly what you're going through but the other guy who's right there? I think it's a natural respect that usually kind of occurs between people. But I think, again,
it depends on the person.
I'm sure it depends on the person. But I would say for most people, you know, it's like there's no, it's not animosity there between their fighters. They love the sport, you know, like they want to achieve things in it, you know, and they're it's also how they're making their living. So it's the way that they approach it.
Yeah, I mean,
but I think that a lot of the time, you know, I think the respect is, I think it comes naturally to most people for that reason, you know, more so than any other. That,
yeah, I agree to a certain extent. Again, I think it depends on the person, you know. Like some guys, if they don't view everybody as competition,
sure,
they can't do what's necessary for them to have success in competition.
That's not even, I'm sure they can view each other as competition, but it's more so that it's like just the kind of sacrifices that people have to make to pursue, you know, sport fighting at a high level. I mean, it's really brutal. It even can be kind of sad sometimes, honestly, because if you don't make very good money and yet the physical toll it takes on your body, I just think that there's an inevitable kind of like camaraderie that you have to have with the other people, man, that are taking those risks and doing that stuff.
This actually leads to a conversation that I have a lot, and it's actually in every profession. So it's like people love talking about like, oh, why, if you wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer, you'd be successful. That's a good career, you know. That's something you can do and you'll make a ton of good money. But nobody wants to talk about the stories where somebody goes to law school and they fail.
Sure.
And they flunk out of law school. Or somebody, maybe they kill it. Like, they're top of their class, and then they get into the field and they make a mistake and they lose their license. Nobody wants to talk about the failure
stories. Medical malpractice.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
People only want to talk about the success stories and the high-level success stories. Yeah. Nobody wants to talk about the person who's just making, like, a good living from it and the failure stories. So, like, if you look at prize fighting, people want to talk about the guys that make the top-of-the-line money, and this happens in boxing, I feel like, more than the other things, because the boxing has the huge pay disparities, bigger than any of the other prize fighting sort of arts. They want to talk about the Floyd Mayweathers and the Anthony Joshuas and the Mike Tysons and the Lennox Lewises of the world. They don't want to talk about the person who fought on the undercard of that was paid $5,000 to show up, and if they never make it to the top tier, they're done.
Sure.
And with boxing, Boxing is like worse about this than any other sport.
Sure.
Where it's like, you lose young in your career, you better not lose a second time, because if you lose a second time, you're done.
Yep.
You're done. Your career's over.
Yeah.
Boxing is all about, you better have a record that shows one or two losses or no losses, or we're not going to make you a star.
Yep.
We can't make you a star unless you look unbeatable.
There's all kinds of questionable stuff that comes with that too, about, you know, guys are just trying to get to, you know, like, you know, 10 wins, no losses, but like, it doesn't really matter who they fought. Exactly.
It doesn't, because they need that record. And that's again, this is the art of prize fighting versus being a martial artist. Because
the entertainment aspect.
It has to be entertainment. And like, you have to be larger than life. And then like, let's talk about professional wrestling. Professional wrestling is the extreme of that.
Yep.
So the whole concept of professional wrestling is about staging fights, scripting fights, so you can make yourself look larger than life.
Yep.
So the whole concept of Hulk Hogan is, Hulk Hogan is larger than life. And this is what sold to kids and sold to teenagers and young adults and made this guy the most successful sports entertainment star for like 15 years.
Yeah.
Is like, he was unbeatable. If somebody's beating him up and he's losing, he can just hulk up and shake and be like, no, this isn't going to happen. So that spectacle became a part Because people didn't realize it was fake for the longest time, even though it's pretty apparent that it's fake.
Yeah. And they consider it like a gray area. It's like, ah, yeah, maybe it's parts of it that are fake, so but the whole thing isn't fake, yeah.
So you have that along the line, and then you add in, like, the boxing padded records where guys are fighting scrubs and people that don't even belong in the rings to get all these things, and then they fight a couple of the top guys, but if they lose a few times, then their career's over.
Yeah.
People don't realize that stuff. So in MMA, you have a guy like Jorge Masvidal is a good, or George, I don't know how it's said, Jorge, George, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Masvidal. He's got like 11 losses. Most of them are just decisions that could have gone either way.
Yep.
But people
yep.
are like, what do you mean? He can't be the biggest star. He has 12 losses. He's like 34-12. And it's like, well, he is really a big star.
Yeah.
But like, he was always taking on the best guys.
Sure.
And lots of those decisions could have gone either way. And now he's
That's actually like a big kind of conflict sometimes you have, in, at least I see in the UFC a lot. Like, it's the Nate Diaz is the prime example of that. That a guy who's like a veteran. You know, he said something in the interview after his first McGregor fight that I found interesting, where it's just like, I've had more losses than he's had fights in MMA. He's like, I've been here doing this for so much longer. So it's kind of like, it depends how you want to. Cowboy is another good example. So, that's like how you want to look at the record. That it's just like,
this is the accumulated
experience.
Because they're older.
Yep.
And they did, they got into MMA initially before the huge boom.
Yep.
Of popularity and before people were making money off of it.
Yeah.
So the thing is that MMA competition, even the UFC at that point, where there was a couple guys like Chuck Liddell and Tito Ortiz making good money.
Like the very top.
Almost
guys,
everybody was making this pennies, and they had to have normal jobs and work. It wasn't a full-time career.
Yep.
You weren't training full-time. So it wasn't that much difference than just being like, hey, I'm going to go to the local Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournament, or I'm going to go to the local Taekwondo tournament. It wasn't that different.
Yeah.
So like the thing is that the losses, having a bunch of losses really didn't matter.
Yeah.
And you had guys back then that had like crazy numbers, like Jeremy Horn, who's like fought like 145 professional MMA matches.
Damn.
You know, you have guys like that. The guy, what's his name? He's actually one of the, Dan Severn. Dan Severn is an old school MMA guy who also did some professional wrestling and was a high level collegiate wrestler. He might have been like, I don't know if he ever wrestled in the Olympics. Like
Freddie Mercury mustache.
Yeah. Don Fry's another guy, same thing. He had the same mustache times Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
But again, a high level wrestler who was like, I don't think was maybe at the level where they could succeed on the world stage, but they were one of the best collegiate wrestlers. It's like, what do? I'm going to fight no holds barred, and I'm going to do professional wrestling and become this entertainer sort of thing. So the thing is that is the foundation, and now we're shifting into MMA, where it's going the route of boxing, where it's like, you better only have a couple losses or you're not larger than life.
I mean,
it's not going to sell to the person.
It's straight up business part of it. They're trying to create stars.
It's also that people that don't train they think that it's not worth watching a person unless they're like a superhero.
Yeah, unless they're undefeated.
And that's the thing. That's really what it is. So like, you see it on both extremes with people that don't train.
Mm-hmm.
So they say either like, this stuff won't work on me because of X, Y, and Z, or they say silly things like, I think it's 50 Cent said recently, he's like, because him and Conor McGregor like each other, he's like, if it's a street fight, I'll crush Conor McGregor because he's so much smaller than me. It's like, dude, Conor McGregor would literally end you in a street fight. Unless you pull a knife or a gun on him, like Conor McGregor will end you within 2 minutes.
Hey man, listen, because McGregor's career has taken a turn for the worst, and you know he continues just to do the smack talk to the extreme, so he's very unlikable for me too. It irritates me.
I've never been a fan of his.
But I mean, in kind of like his peak, you know, around when he fought Aldo, Mendez, Alvarez, you know, it's like those fights. I mean, he was wrecking people. I mean, McGregor was...
He's beat Max Holloway. He's beat Dustin Poirier. He's beaten all the best guys.
And that's why a lot of people, you know, kind of even point to him already as, you know, like a victim of his own success kind of thing. That, you know, when he was on that rise and, you know, he was kind of fighting to, you know, to be at the very top of it, you know, he was really, really fun fighter to watch and very talented guy. And then kind of after he made all that money, it just seemed like he lost it.
I think that's getting overstated a little bit.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, it is what it is. It's so going back to my, but the bigger point I'm trying to make is that the average person wants this, like, and this is why the heavyweights and the light heavyweights and the bigger guys are so popular. People want to be sold this idea of a person who can crush them.
Yeah.
And like the thing is in their mind, they're like, well, Demetrius Johnson weighs 125 pounds. I'm so much bigger than him, I'll kill him. It's like, that is not how it actually works.
Sure.
But people don't know.
Size matters, but Demetrius Johnson...
Size matters if you've actually trained and you have some skill.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's a dude who is a serious martial artist. I mean, he's just the best in the world.
This is what people want that don't know. So, like, people just assume, they're like, well, this guy is bigger and stronger than you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've talked about my size multiple times. So people are like, you're 140 to 145 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm just too big for you. And then they come in and they experience it and they're like, I don't understand what happened. And I'm not even that great in the grand scheme of things. There are killers out there in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu who, if you walked in and you think you're like, I'm 220, I'm super strong, I'm fit.
Yeah.
They'll tie you up into a pretzel and not even care.
Yeah, man. Technique works. It works. You know,
same thing. Yeah. There's strikers out there. They'll blast these guys with one leg kick and they'll fall.
Sure.
They've never felt one of those things. They've never felt that shin digging right into the thigh bone.
Hey, listen. I've met a lot of, you know, coming from the karate world with that background, that, you know, like smaller guys, especially a lot of the high level, like Japanese instructors. I mean, you know, they will knock you out, you know. They have consistent knockout power. It's not, the size has, you know, it makes a difference and you shouldn't pretend that it just doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, if you have somebody, and of course coming from a striking background, I'm sure it's the same with the grappling, that if you have somebody that really does have very high level technique, they can strike fast, they can strike hard, they know how to move and position themselves, that kind of thing. It's like, you can't really, you know, it doesn't matter how big you are. It's like that advantage is so huge. You know, of course, if you take somebody with comparable skills or even skills that aren't on the same level, but they have that huge size advantage, then of course that's going to change things entirely.
There are people that are outliers that are just physical freaks.
Yep.
That it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you need a certain comparable level of physical gifts coupled with skill to hang in there with them. That's like well beyond there. Those people are outliers.
Yep.
They're outliers. There's a few of them like anything.
Yeah.
But they're few and far between. Like people think that those people are just walking around every day. No. You meet, if you're lucky, you might encounter like one or two of those people in your life.
Sure.
Those people are not everyday people.
Yeah.
They're just some freak of natures, and they might not even be as big as you think they are.
Oh, yeah.
That exist. But like, I mean, if you listen to guys that fight professionally in anything, they'll tell you things like, man, this guy hit me with some leg kicks.
Mm-hmm.
And my life has been altered ever since. I think it's Randy Couture says, there was some Brazilian fighter he fought who I think Randy Couture ended up winning the fight, but the guy leg kicked him like 50 times in the fight. He's like, there is a permanent dent in my leg from where he leg kicked me.
Sure.
Those leg kicks altered my life.
Yeah.
They've changed me. I think Uriah Faber said the same thing on his first match with Aldo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see pictures, you guys can Google it, of like Uriah Faber at post Aldo fight leg picture. He had eaten so many leg kicks, his thigh is literally like one thigh, the thigh that kept getting kicked, is three times the size of the other leg.
Yeah.
And it's
just, I've seen it before.
It's just, and it's like with adrenaline. Yeah, yeah. With huge. Adrenaline, yeah. You just keep going.
Yeah.
You just keep going. But it's like that altered his life. Yeah. Uriah Faber was not the same fighter after that match.
Yeah, leg kicks can be fight-ending techniques. You know, you can find a lot. And a lot of the time for people that haven't ever taken, like, a hard leg kick, it's just like, it's shock. I mean, you just drop a lot of the time.
It doesn't have to be hard. So I actually think I had you give me, like, a tap leg kick. Something that wasn't that hard years ago.
Sure.
And I was like, Jesus Christ. I was like, I think I'm pretty durable. I train jiu-jitsu. I'm pretty, like, I'm relatively tough. I'm undersized. I'll take on any person in training. I don't care. I do open weight class sometimes in competitions. You, like, tapped me, and I was like, Jesus Christ. If that was full power, one of those, I'd be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be done. My whole leg would be tingling and numb, and there's a guy I trained with, Don. You know Don.
Yeah.
Obviously. I was holding a pad in front of my leg, and I was like, I just want you to leg kick me with full power.
Yeah.
I remember Don maybe is like 185 at the time.
Sure. Tall, lanky.
Yeah, yeah. He's done striking his entire life. Muay Thai, boxing, and Tung Soo.
Tung Soo was the original
style. I was holding it, and I remember he leg kicked me, and I was like, literally, I was like, the amount of movement that occurred and the amount I slid across the floor with him doing full power and me having that pad in front, I was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, if that were to connect with me full force in the right way, I'm done. One of those, I'm done.
There's a video that was floating around. Joe Rogan talked about it on his podcast where I saw it, of just like two dudes having a fight in a parking lot. And the guy obviously had some kind of MMA training. It was probably MMA training because he did a double leg takedown
afterwards. I saw that.
When he hit the guy with that leg kick,
the dude's leg was dead.
He literally just did a 180. I mean, the guy just dropped to the ground he was just standing there. He wasn't in any kind of stance. Yeah. He wasn't ready for it. So literally, he hit his legs. He went through both legs, and the guy just dropped.
And when the guy stands up, he's limping.
Yeah,
he's noticeably limping, and he double leg takedown. And Eddie Bravo we've talked about this before. Yeah. Eddie Bravo was like, he used the S word, which I won't use right now, but he was like, he's like, it was a crappy double leg takedown.
Yeah.
It's not even a good double leg takedown. Sure. And that dude's out cold. Stiff as can be.
That's a perfect example. I know we've talked about it on here before, but most people have just such a warped perception of fighting, and just the idea like, oh, you know, I'm bigger than you and I'll get really angry and I'm gonna come at you really hard. And it's like, sure, and listen, I'm a big advocate of self-defense, and I think everybody is dangerous, and I think that's the mentality that you should have in your training. Everybody has the potential to harm you, and take those threats seriously. But, you know, like, when you talk about like the fullness of like something like MMA, or just combat sports in general, and you know, like how many years and how much effort you have to put in to try to develop these skills that work in a sporting context like that. I mean, stuff works. You know, Mighty Mouse, man, I'm sure a guy literally twice his size, you know, that hitting him in the legs with kicks, he's using good motion to, you know, keep around him like that. He's able to hit him with precision punches, you know, when he comes in close. It's just, that's a very, very high level right there.
Yeah.
You're able to make up the difference in size, problem.
In addition to that, I'm pretty sure that Mighty Mouse's initial base was wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no way an unskilled person is going to prevent him from just dumping him on his head.
Sure.
I don't care if the guy's 250.
Yep.
Like, unless you know the takedown is coming and you've trained takedowns, preventing somebody who knows how to take somebody down.
Yeah. Doesn't even know how to sprawl. You know, it doesn't matter if he's 250.
It's the same
pounds.
Thing. Yeah. It's like if you, I don't care if you've done grappling and you're a high level grappler. If you never encountered somebody who has a good jab or a good cross, a good hook, or a good leg kick, you're in trouble. Because, like, if somebody's unskilled throws a crappy haymaker, of course you're going to see it. Yeah, you're going to see it coming and it's going to be done.
Yeah.
But if they have some skill, well, they're training so that you don't see the strikes coming. That's the purpose of training.
Sure.
So you're training so that that when you throw the jab out there, they don't see the jab. And like, I mean, I personally, as a non-striker, I did some karate when I was a kid.
Yeah.
As a non-striker, I think all myself all the time when I watch these guys fighting that are good grapplers who don't, who are just like never focused too much on the strike. I'm like, just focus on having a jab and a leg kick.
Yeah.
If you have a good jab, like, who cares about the rest of the striking? If you want to just dominate people from striking or from grappling, just get a good jab and a good leg kick, and these guys are done.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to knock them out properly. It's not going to stop the fight, but it's going to get them not wanting to step in.
Sure. I would say jab, cross, leg kick. You know, if you kind of just have that, and even just from the grappling side of things, then you add that to your training, then you're able to, you get a lot of experience defending against it too. You know, it's like, that's probably the more valuable piece of the puzzle.
So we talked about Georges St-Pierre. Georges St-Pierre is the most interesting, like, study of fighting ever. So Georges St-Pierre should hopefully be talked about the way that Bruce Lee is talked about right now. Yeah. Hopefully in 30 years people talk about Georges St-Pierre the way they talk about Bruce Lee. So he starts by training in karate, right?
Kyokushin karate.
Yeah.
A very specific style, very heavy on kicks.
So he starts there, transitions to MMA, and he's training at a school with a guy who is a, I don't know at the time if he was a black belt under Renzo Gracie, but he was at least a brown belt.
Yeah.
So he starts training there to make the shift to MMA, but he's very much a karate-based striker.
Yeah.
He somehow takes that skill set as his foundation and becomes one of the best wrestlers in MMA history.
Yeah. Yeah, to the point that, you know, like, when I think of phenomenal strikers in MMA, GSP is not at the top of my list. So, you know, it's that his double leg takedown.
To make it more confusing, he comes from a country that traditionally has awful wrestling in Canada. So he is known, his base is karate.
Yeah.
He's known for being a phenomenal wrestler from a country that has terrible wrestling, and his home-based school is owned by a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt under Renzo Gracie. So he's got a pedigree that's insanely talented for Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And this guy then pretty much transformed himself into being a guy who pretty much throws jabs to set up double leg takedowns and then mauls you on the ground.
Yeah.
And makes that into his whole game and pretty much becomes the most successful MMA fighter of all time.
Yep.
So his base is karate, and that's what he used. He uses his striking at the beginning of his career, and then completely transforms himself into a guy who uses his jab to set up double leg takedowns. And it's like,
that definitely was his main.
He peppers
thing.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah. He peppers you with the jab, and then he just has you step and he jabs you. He has you step and he jabs you. And then you step in and then he changes levels.
But to be fair, Georges St-Pierre, the same way that it's something that he was kind of a important, you know, kind of figure in the MMA history. He was a guy who could do everything, was the point. That he could stand and he could strike with you. He also, you know, was good on the ground, and of course, you know, that double leg takedown, the ground and pound, was kind of what won him most of his fights.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. But he was a true, you know, mixed martial artist. That he was a guy who could do everything well. So I think that's big part of his success. I mean, listen, Georges St-Pierre too also strikes me as a little bit of a freak athlete. I mean, the dude is.
He definitely is.
Yeah, yeah. So
there's no question about that. Yeah. Again, and that to make it to the highest levels, especially in this day and age, really, really for now over a decade, if you don't have athleticism, you're going to have a hard time. So, like, somebody who's not super athletic that has had success would be the Diaz brothers.
Yeah.
They're not super athletic.
Athletic enough, though. The way it was put to me once was about football. They said that it's like, when you make it to the NFL, it's kind of like the difference between, you know, just your average NFL player and the guy that's in the top players like that, it's like, it's no longer physical. It's kind of like everybody that's there is a talented athlete. You know, it's like there's something else. Obviously, the UFC is is often similar.
This is an interesting thing, though. So I don't think any person would consider me athletic at all. But
I don't know, man. I wouldn't say that you're unathletic.
My instructor, Alberto, has said this to me. He's like, well, you've done jiu-jitsu for over 8 years, and you've never had, like, really any injuries.
Yeah.
He's like, so it's pretty hard to not be athletic and that be the case. So, like, the thing is that I think that we in the United States, because the popular sports are hockey, baseball, football, and basketball.
Sure.
Now, hockey and baseball, you don't necessarily need to be a absolute stud physical specimen to play.
Matters what position, I guess, that you're in. But
I just think in general you don't have to be.
Yeah.
But in football and basketball, you have to be.
Yeah.
You have to have physical gifts that are just like through the roof. You have been blessed with physical gifts genetically that the average person can never even conceive of. And then in addition to that, you have to have, for all any professional sport, you have to have a drive to succeed that even if you are on the bottom end of hard work in that sport, it's still more than the average person will ever conceive of as far as hard work.
Sure.
But most of those guys that don't want to work super hard, they flame out in a couple of years.
There's a guy who went to my high school. There's a guy who went to my high school that ended up playing in the NFL. And I remember being like 15 years old, and I saw him in the hallway, and he was just like jacked.
Well, I mean,
you know, it was just one of those things. Like, I don't think that he was like just working out at 15. Had been like working out for years to develop that. It's just genetic.
You went to Laura Marion High School, so did I. So Kobe Bryant was obviously from our high school before either of us were there. But there's a guy named Ryan Brooks, who played at Temple, college basketball, and then played overseas professionally. I think he still does. In Europe.
Yeah.
Again, just absolute freak of nature, but you know, he's like a tier that's right below being in the NBA, but he's a freak of nature.
Sure.
Absolute freak of nature.
Man, everybody's got different gifts genetically, you know. Like that's the way that works.
But my point is that people see the football and basketball players and they're like, you're not athletic or an A-level athlete unless you have those sort of gifts. Sure. And they don't understand that there's plenty of guys that are doing something else, like John Jones. John Jones' two brothers are in the NFL.
Yeah, absolutely.
Both brothers have won Super Bowl rings and been Pro Bowlers.
Cool.
You know, it's like John Jones couldn't play in the NFL like his brothers could.
It's got a different kind of athleticism.
The dude is a freak athlete.
Sure.
And if he... John Jones is... Despite all his weird, wacky issues, the dude is super talented and has to work hard, because if he didn't, other people would get him.
Yeah.
He would have been caught by now.
Yeah, something you and I have in common is that kind of neither of us really were, well, for lack of a better way to put it, neither of us were jocks. You know, like, we never really pursued athleticism.
Yeah.
In other aspects of our lives, but then got into martial arts. You know, it's like martial arts is something that it has... And of course it's an athletic activity, it has an athletic element to it, but there's also, it's a different kind of athleticism that you can develop. And it's one of those things that, like, my hand-eye coordination, like, it wasn't particularly good as a kid. I didn't grow up, you know, throwing a ball around a lot or anything like that. I was kind of a nerdy kid. And, but started doing karate at a relatively young age and loved it and just did it. I've done almost 20 years I've been training now. It's kind of, I don't think I'm unathletic, but I'm not a gifted athlete like that. But if you spend 20 years consistently practicing something, you will develop athleticism from that. You know?
I mean, I think it's sometimes hard to tell, man, to be honest. It's like the chicken and egg argument.
Yeah,
because I feel like I'm not athletic at all, and then I have people that spend time around athletes all the time. They're like, "Yeah, your ability to do that thing, I don't know what you're talking about not being athletic."
Yeah, I teach, you know, a lot of kids. I mean, I know you do too, so I'm sure you have a similar experience. But I mean, you know, there are some students that you get that it's a struggle to get them to do anything. I don't get the impression that I was that bad. When I was a new student, I don't know. You know, remember, I was 9 years old, you know, trying to remember that. Like, I wasn't that difficult of a student, but I certainly wasn't a star. You know, I didn't pick things up really easily like other people.
I know we got to wrap up this conversation pretty soon, but one thing that's interesting to me is the opposite end, the kids that are like so naturally good, and you're like, tell them, you're like, you're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, but you're making it work.
They're getting away with it, and you're like, you're doing the wrong thing. I know it's working for you right now, but I'm telling you, when somebody you run to somebody who has more athleticism than you or equal athleticism, that will not work. And this is a whole other podcast that we can obviously talk about. It's hard to explain to those people. They don't want to listen. It's like, well, it's working. How can you tell me that what I'm doing is wrong because it's working?
Yep.
It's working.
Not planning long-term enough. Yeah. You don't want to develop this bad habit. So just to bring it back to the trash talking and, you know, sport fighting kind of thing that we started with, I think it's worth mentioning Khabib in all of this. I found that whole McGregor, you know, his fight with him to be an interesting one because there was a cultural element to it. There was suddenly thing. Where it's pretty accepted.
Here's the thing about him, though, man. I gotta say this. I'm sure Khabib is. Well, I've never met a guy who isn't a fighter who isn't super nice.
Sure.
So I think that's important to remember because I think that it changes you. It changes you in a way that people don't understand. Even if you're just competing in your own martial art, it changes you when you do it and you've done it multiple times. It changes your like understanding of like, hey, any person can be a killer. I'm going to stick with.
Yeah.
Khabib is not a super nice. He doesn't have the reputation of being like a super nice, respectful guy in every situation himself.
Sure.
Supposedly there's an old story of like Nate Diaz's crew getting into like a straight up brawl
I've seen
with his
the video.
Crew.
Yeah.
Like and other people have said that stuff like that has happened.
Well, so, you know where he's from, Kazakhstan. Yeah, it's a little bit.
The second that he thinks
place.
anything is disrespectful has been done.
Yeah.
And it could be something simple like where you're like, he didn't hear you say excuse me when you cut in line. Supposedly it's like, boom, we're going.
I haven't heard that, but I just found it interesting that I think there's a little bit of a cultural divide there where, you know, it's understood that the trash talking is kind of a part of the business.
McGregor crossed the line, he made it personal.
Well, it's not anything personal.
Yeah,
but
you don't say anything about people's families.
I mean, especially with
anything
him.
About people's religion. He's just not from a
Western cultural
background. To be
perfectly
honest, again, this mostly comes
true.
From Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor has made multiple racist comments.
Yeah.
I mean, he said about Jose Aldo, he was like, if it was 1925, I would have gone into your favela and like killed your family and raped your woman. So like
yeah, that's
again,
pretty,
again,
that's pretty not. Yeah,
but
that's
like
pretty
like funny. Again, this is the thing though. Is does Conor McGregor believe what he's saying, or is he saying it to sell a fight? And you don't
okay,
know.
But it is the bigger thing is that does it matter? Because a guy like Khabib, you know, I feel like it's not that he maybe didn't understand that you know he's just doing that
well,
to sell the fight.
It depends on the person.
But yeah, exactly. It gets to a point that it's like I don't really care.
Everybody has their breaking points and all. Yeah. Like I consider myself pretty laid back, but I have my breaking point, and there's some people that can get me to that point.
It's unhealthy not to.
You got
to have a point where
again, another conversation.
Sure.
I mean, people treat you how you let them treat you.
Yeah.
And there's also the golden rule is a common thing that we talk about all the time in the classes I teach, but it's a good rule to follow. It's like treat other people how you want to be treated.
Closest thing we have to universal morality.
Yeah, yeah. But like, man, if you let somebody get away with disrespect once, they'll disrespect you for the rest of your life. And I have personal experiences where I let somebody disrespect me for years, and now I'm still paying the cost.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm still paying the cost, and they choose to disrespect me every chance they get.
Yeah, that's why, and I don't know if you agree, and we gotta wrap it up, we're almost out of time here, but, you know, that's why with all the brawl that happened after the McGregor fight with Khabib, like, I really didn't think that it was something that was so horrible on Habib's end. I was like, listen, I you know, if I was in that situation, I'm not saying that's what I, the way that I would have wanted to have handled it, you know, it's like that. But at the same time, I kind of recognize the cultural divide. And like you're saying with it, that it's like some people just decide to draw a line in the sand.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, guys. Go train. And this is definitely a topic that'll reappear at some point in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Fun one to talk about. All right. Until next time.